Okay. Now's our opportunity to come down a little bit in altitude, okay? We're going to, in some of you cases, we're going to be way down on the ground, and some of you, it's not going to be relevant what we're talking about. Certainly, if your loved one or yourself dealing with don't have much in the way of resources, then our discussions of public benefits, for instance, might be really relevant. For those of you who have been, I want to be careful of my language here. Those of you who have the responsibility as stewards of larger amounts of resources, or your loved ones are stewards of larger amounts of resources, then some of that the discussion might not be as relevant, but our discussion about some ways in which you need to be able to manage costs will be more relevant for you. So bear with us. Somebody in the room hopefully will be blessed by something and everything that we talk about. The one thing that all of us have in common, and the overarching theme of this second section of our time together, is the notion of a plan. Okay? So I've given you a couple of you know, Richard's little axioms, right? All right. So the first one was that everything is different in light of the kingdom. If you didn't get that one across, I think I wasted a lot of breath. The second one was along the lines of all decisions are theological and all good decisions are missional. Here comes your third axiom, if you will. Everybody needs a plan. I want to be clear, not everybody needs an insurance product. Not everybody needs a particular asset allocation portfolio management. Not everyone needs to have somebody who gets paid to help them walk it through. And to be honest with you, not everybody needs a will or a trust or any of these other things that you may have actually inadvertently paid money for that you didn't need to. Everybody needs a plan. Number of years ago, I had a great conversation, gentleman. I was in Houston at the time, and he was a man of some influence and some resources. And I was sharing with him what I do for a living, what I care about, and what I was working on. And you know, I blew it. I missed my opportunity. The whole plane ride back home, talking with my colleagues. I was telling Don here that I have two business partners. Actually, both of whom have some affiliation with what we're doing here. Bob Ross is one of my partners. He's a certified financial planner. And actually, those of you Parkside folks, his brother Mike and sister-in-law Joan are missionaries down in Oaxaca, Mexico with MAF. Hence the altitude elevation metaphors would probably work perfectly well for those folks. Mission Aviation Fellowship. The other guy named Craig King, who's a CPA, who has occasionally blessed us with his voice on a Sunday morning from time to time. More thankfully, his family members have. Yes, Craig, that was for you. In any case, I was talking with my partners about it afterward, and I blew it. This guy had an opportunity to open up some doors for me. Obviously, the Lord, everything does in his timing, and I trust that by living by faith, without faith, it's impossible to please God. But the guy asked me flat out, Richard, what would you like to see happen? I understand what you're doing with your work. What do you want to have happen in this world? And it was only on the airplane ride back that I realized the answer to that was that one day we'd have a time where an elder care plan was as normal as a will. Where it was just something that you would never consider going away from your financial advisor without recognizing the importance of tax, without recognizing the importance of estate planning, without recognizing the importance of your investment and investment advisory planning. But I have no idea how I'm going to deal with what might be one of the largest expenditures way at the tail end of my journey, interfering with everything else that I'm trying to achieve at the tail end of my journey, that incidentally could also be a risk that affects me tomorrow in my young life, either by a chronic illness that I didn't anticipate coming up or in one sudden event that in this very vulnerable world can happen to me. So that a plan for long-term care, a plan for elder care, not a product, not a solution ahead of a plan, but a plan that then leads me to some action steps toward reasonable solutions, that would be normative for everybody. I would argue that from the perspective of a certified financial planner, Richard's argument is that preparing for the cost of a chronic illness is not simply a part of a good financial plan. It's actually the true test of a good financial plan. One of the most significant challenges at a significant time that affects everything else. That's the next axiom. Let me talk to you about planning for a second, okay? Now remember, our guide rules were that first section of what we did together was not just letting Richard go off in his theology lesson, right? The first part was that since we came to the conclusion that everything is different in light of the kingdom, and that this relationship that we have with the Lord changes all of our decision-making about very mundane things in some ways, then now we're going to go into a discussion about planning and some specific action steps that seem reasonable and steps in planning. For some of you, early baby steps. For some of you, knee deep in the middle of it. What do I do now in this crisis that I'm in? But in either case, we're talking about planning. God is not silent. And sometimes the ways in which he tells us stuff that we need to be thinking about is in direct statements. Sometimes it is in parables. Sometimes it is in poetry. Sometimes it is in history. Let me give you a little piece of history. Many years ago, actually, at the encouragement of some teaching that was done by Alistair Begg, this had to be a couple of decades ago, in studying the book of Nehemiah, I decided that, wow, that was a really interesting story that I wanted to learn more about. And actually used it as a significant portion of my MBA program, studying how one goes about the steps organizationally of planning and administrating an endeavor in light of faith. Okay? For those of you who don't know the story, let me give you a quickie a synopsis on it. Nehemiah had kind of an influential job. He had an interesting job. He was the cupbearer to the king. Okay, remember the people of Israel were spread all over the place at this point. He's living with folks who were not believers. He was working for what turned out to be a pretty honorable guy, but not one who necessarily followed the one true God. And his job was cupbearer. For those of you that may sound kind of mundane, this is the last person that drinks your wine before you drink your wine. Kind of an important trust position, okay? In a time where poisons were all over the place and politics were very violent. So the cupbearer to the king was an extremely trusted position. Well, Nehemiah hears from his brother, I think. Somebody comes to him, I believe it was his brother, comes to him and says, "Hey, did you hear about the wall? You know, some of the people of Israel, even in the midst of all of this spreading, some of the people of Israel are all together, and they're living inside of the walls of Old Jerusalem, and the walls have broken down." Now, I won't stretch the metaphor too far, but in light of what we just talked about previously, think about that notion of the walls breaking down. It is both a spiritual crisis, and it is a practical, mundane crisis. Very similar to what I'm trying to present to you about elder care. The spiritual crisis, why? Because the walls represented the protection. They respected the authority. Inside that thing, there were important things. Inside that thing was, you know, protection of the Ark of the Covenant. Inside were protections of important things that represented God's honor. Walls breached, walls went down, meant we weren't treating these things that are holy in a way that they should be treated. Think about that and what I said about vigilance, defensive dignity, the other roles we take on as caregivers. Okay? So this was a God thing, and it was an important God thing. It was dishonoring that those walls were down, and Nehemiah knew that, and he took that, and it upset him deeply. The scriptures talk about him ripping his clothes, talk about him going into mourning when he heard about this. God's honor was a big deal to him, and this was a threat to God's honor. You threaten the things that God has called holy, and you are at that point now, you're in God's space. You got to do something about that. That would include a human being that God has said, "I have set this apart. This one's holy. This is special to me. So much so, I would have my one and only son die in order to have that one back." That person's special. Created special, redeemed special, mine. They are holy. They are set apart for me. Interesting similarities in our situations. So as a spiritual crisis, there's also a practical one. Practically, there were human beings inside those walls. Women, children, women who could be raped, children who could be kidnapped and stolen away as slaves. This is a real practical problem here that we had to do something about. So Nehemiah sees the measure. All the guy's basically asking for is, give me a leave of absence, will ya? I mean, there was no Family Medical Leave Act at the time. Please, boss, can you cut me some slack? It's an amazing story of God's hand in the midst of this. So by the time he leaves, he not only has free time, he has papers that allow him safe passage where he needs to go. He's got timber with him. He's got workers with him. He's moving on, doing this amazing project by God's hand to rebuild the walls. And what the scriptures tell us is, in this amazing process of an amazing relationship between Nehemiah as a leader and Ezra as the spiritual leader, the prophet Ezra as the spiritual leader of these people, working together, understanding their roles, family by family, they start building these walls back up. In an interesting process, they're building it with one family, literally, blood kin, next to another family, next to another family, next to another family. You want a picture for what the Church of Jesus Christ should probably look like? Now you've got something, the sanctity of the family unit, but interspersed among the people of God, working right along, side by side, understanding, you know, listening to the argument of the teenage kid in the family next to you about whining how he doesn't want to be doing this wall thing, and who cares about the wall thing, and can I have the chariot for Saturday night, please? Family by family doing this, rebuilding that wall. Well, the scriptures tell us that there's one point in the process where the bad guys in the story, Sanballat and his crew, are out watching this thing, and they were mocking it. They thought the whole thing was really funny. There's no way these guys are going to build a wall. Well, the thing got up pretty high at some point when all of a sudden it dawned on them, oh my, these guys are really going to pull this off. So they started sneaking in at night, knocking down hunks of the wall, breaching in. And so the people came to Nehemiah and complained about that and said, you know, we wake up in the morning and some of the hunks of the wall are gone. What are we going to do? And he came to the prophet Ezra, and Nehemiah and Ezra made the announcement, or as the scripture tells us, but we prayed to our God and posted a guard day and night to meet this threat. So from that point forward, you had one guy with a spear standing while the rest of his family was doing the work, and they were taking turns making sure nobody was going around the clock going to be able to mess with this thing. Practically, they guarded that which was vulnerable. They guarded them that were vulnerable. So again, the spiritual and the practical are intertwined at the level of the plan, the creation and the administration of that particular plan. We need to come about this in the exact same way. That's the way that we do planning here when we live in a world that says we live by faith, and that without faith, it's impossible to please God. We have a particular approach at my firm. The fact that, you know, I'll try to avoid plugs here, but there's some things that are worth plugging. The name of my firm is Integrity Financial. I shared that with you guys earlier. And the program or the initiative that I work on, we refer to as the Age of Integrity. Aetas de Integritas. It's actually, if I do the Latin correctly, I think it's Aetas de Integritatis. But you know what? A lot more syllables, a little tougher in that regard. Age of Integrity. Age of Integrity is a term that actually goes back to the early developmental psychologists in terms of what that last period of our life looks like. Integrity means two things. Obviously, particularly relative to a financial services firm, you guys think of the first definition, adherence to moral or ethical principles, being upright, upstanding, staying close to some kind of plumb line or true spot. Okay? That's integrity. We get that. Moral consistency, if you will, is integrity. But integrity has another meaning. If you go to your dictionary, you realize we just don't normally use it in that context as a noun. We use it as in the context of a modifier when we talk about something being integrated, or even worse, being disintegrated. Integrity is the state of being whole, of being one. Those of us that have studied aging have discovered that, in fact, older folks become much more difficult to use a reductionist approach because, to be honest, they are becoming, as we age, all of us in this room, we are becoming increasingly integrated. We are becoming increasingly whole. It becomes tougher and tougher to make the differentiations between that which is physical, that which is emotional, that which is spiritual. I won't ask for a show of hands, but any of you in this room that have ever had to deal with mom or dad's urinary tract infection know exactly what I'm talking about. How one tiny little microbe could put you in a situation of a flailing delirium in an otherwise stable person. How something that space between that which is physical and that which is emotional, that which is cognitive, all of a sudden becomes very, very blurred. And that's true as well in the spiritual and the emotional. We know that. Why is it that I can sit with a markedly demented person, knowing, having learned a few things about their past background? They have no communications with anyone else. At this point, one would consider them to be in severe, late-stage dementia, incapable of making regular contact and communication. But if I start to sing Jesus Loves Me, This I Know, I'm clearly getting a reaction that tells me there's a connection between my world and their world. Why is that? Why is that? But everyone, any of you who volunteer in the nursing home ministry, know exactly what I'm talking about. The space starts to become less and less important. We can't forget that. That element of integrity when we're doing the planning. If all of a sudden we sit there and we say, okay, well, yeah, I'm with you, Richard, on all that theology stuff, and okay, I get a rough idea of what you're talking about on the psychology stuff, but, you know, it's practical now. Let's get a plan in place here. We forget to keep resonating those principles in the midst of the plan. Our plan is going to be just that. It's just going to be, it's going to be very, very objective engineering. It's not we're going to lose the forest for the trees in the midst of it. Whoa. Hopefully that's printed correctly on your page. Is it? Okay. Okay. Sorry, the folks on the recording have no idea what we're looking at. Please look at the page in front of you rather than the slide in front of you. Here's how, when we talk about, aetas integritas, how do we go about planning with a sense of integrity? What we're recognizing is when we're dealing with care choices and the development of a care plan, we have to keep in mind all those elements that are not distinct parts. They are, in fact, a part of a whole. They are, in fact, as for those of you who are, again, bent toward things more philosophical, they are what in German would be referred to as the Gestalt. They are greater than and different than the sum of their parts. What are those things? Faith being the overarching element of who we are, our orientation toward God and orientation toward others via God has to be kept in balance with other factors. Before we ever get to issues around finances, we have to talk about family, we have to talk about function. Why do I use the word function instead of diagnosis? Because there's a strong correlation in many cases between a medical diagnosis and function, but in the end, when we're dealing with planning, we're not talking about what you got, we talk about what you got left. What can you do? What can you not do? How closely that approximates to say to me, someone, as some of you asked, great questions, incidentally, good erudite questions. One of you asked the question about Alzheimer's disease and dementia and how I make sense of all of this thing. And we could talk about it from the perspective of what we know from the scientific community. But in the end, for me to say, oh, yes, that person is, and I don't say this in a pejorative sense, that person is demented, past tense, okay? Tells you next to nothing. It means that they had to decline from a previous level of their cognitive functioning. If they were never that bright to begin with, the decline is going to look different than if they were a rocket scientist. Okay? It's a decline from a previous level of cognitive functioning. That's all that dementia means. Progressive dementia means it's happening over time. Over time like a decades or over time like the last couple of weeks? Because if it's the last couple of weeks, that ain't dementia. That's some kind of delirium, and let's go over to the urgent care, get a nice urinalysis done, some blood samples, see what else is going on here, because nothing moves that fast in terms of neuronal loss. So it doesn't really tell you a whole lot necessarily for me to list off all their ICD-9 codes for you guys. The important thing is here is function. Activities of daily living, instrumental activities of daily living, what this person can do, what this person can't do, recognizing over time and, incidentally, in context. I think I'm moderately functioning human being, adult human being in this society. I absolutely assure you, you put me in some context and I'm going to do a lot better, higher performance than I am in other contexts. If, in fact, as I was doing this whole first part of this presentation, sharing with you my heart about Jesus and about the relevance of Jesus, had there not been at least a dozen of you people who your faces just encouraged me, kept me moving, that there was, that, yeah, you get it. We get it. We're together on this thing. In that context, those were easy words to say. As you can imagine, particularly having been a university professor, there were other contexts where saying those same things was a very challenging thing to do. And so on and so on. So when I went, inevitably, the best example I can think of is someone with progressive dementia. As a colleague of mine, Nancy Mace, described at one point, when you're dealing with someone who has dementia and there's a problem behavior, the first thing you want to do is reassess. Make sure that they don't have some kind of excess disability, that urinary tract infection, for example. But the next thing you need to do is reconsider. Is it possible that this person would be perfectly fine if I took them out of the context they're in and placed them in a different context? Any of us that have gone through the journey of walking mom or dad into a assisted living environment, where there's all this tension about leaving the house, they go to the assisted living environment, and often there's a short period of delirium, even in an otherwise very strong, cognitively strong older adult period, because they're in a new space. They got to acclimate to this new space. Everything's different. The routines are different. The physical space is different. And you're thinking, oh, no, what did I do? I made her worse by bringing her here. And then about 6 weeks later, it looks like 3 to 4 to 6 weeks later, it starts to lift. Everything's good. And then all of a sudden, she starts to look like she's better than she was back at home. And you're thinking, what was I thinking? She didn't need to be here in the first place. And how much is this costing every month? Because, in fact, the walking on eggshells that she had back at home, the vulnerabilities that she had at home trying to manage all those things were actually dragging her down in terms of her abilities. With somebody else to provide three squares, with somebody with not having that risk of inadvertently putting that piece of tin foil into the microwave, all of a sudden life becomes a little easier and I can engage and it looks like my function is doing a lot better than it was before. So the function is contextual. So when we're doing the planning, faith, absolutely, overarching. Function, clearly a major driver. Function, health, how I do what I do in daily living. Family, there is no greater piece of context than family, and I think you all know that in that regard. And we're going to talk a little bit more in detail about that. But the resources and the obstacles that come from working through a family system are, in fact, the greatest complication in most care planning situations. As I said to you before, not having family is a high risk factor for a lot of things that are expensive and sometimes less than pleasant. Conversely, having family doesn't necessarily mean that the plan's going to go smoothly and that the action steps in implementing that plan are necessarily going to go smoothly. Family is family, right? And incidentally, for any of you who can't think of that quirky family member that's hard to get along with and makes things really difficult, you are that quirky family member that's making everything difficult. Okay. Then the last piece is the finances, the resources. What do we have to work with? Can I make one sort of biblical finance comment at this point? And if we need to go into further detail about this, thankfully Parkside, at least a couple of times every year, I've had the privilege to be a part of leading some of the stewardship stuff that goes on here. But here's your basic principle from Richard's world. Money is always a means. It is never an end. Never. This is not a game to see who accumulates what. This is not a game to see how much is on my statement compared to before. This is not a game to see how my statement relates to the Standard & Poor's 500. It is a resource. It is used toward purposes, toward objectives. And again, the best of those have theologically driven decisions and that they are missional in one way or another. It's a resource. It's a means, not an end. It is grease. It is not gear. And it's really important for us to keep our minds on dollars being in that, from that perspective. When you embrace stewardship, it's God's money, guys. When you really kind of get that at your core, that you have the privilege and the duty of managing God's resources for that period of time, that He would entrust you with that. And some of you, because, frankly, you have been faithful and He's entrusted you with more of it than you thought you'd ever have to be responsible for, that does not change the fact that you approach it as a steward, not an owner. And incidentally, if I might point out, somebody in my posture, somebody in my business, is a servant to the steward, nothing more. It's not your money, It's not their money, it's God's money. And it has an objective and it has a purpose. Some of those are for the people that we love. Some of those are for the challenges that we're going to walk through. Some of those are for people we've never met, will never meet. But boy, could they use a mosquito net tomorrow night, given the malaria that is surrounding them, and so on and so on and so on. Or the very cold nights that exist in Northeast Ohio this time of the year. All of it has a purpose, and the plan needs to consider. So there's a number of steps, and this is what I'm going to walk you through in this period of time that we have together. Let me walk through what I think would apply to everybody in this room at some level, whether you're deeply in crisis or whether you are just starting to think about how do I talk with mom and dad or how do I talk with my kids about these matters. I think these steps apply to everybody. And it identifies planning, having a plan, as a tool of stress reduction, okay? And I'll make that point more clearly biblically in just a second, but these are the steps that I'd like us to walk through. How do we replace anxiety with information so that we can bring in something to be able to not have it this diffuse? Again, we talk about anxiety in a very specific way in the behavioral sciences community. Anxiety is not a pinpoint focused fear or threat. It is more that diffuse feeling of foreboding. Something not good is happening here. It's been well studied and well recognized. Hildegard Peplau, I probably say her name just because I like that name. But in any case, Dr. Hildegard Peplau did some wonderful work recognizing the fact of what happens to our attention, our ability to be able to focus on a piece of information in light of anxiety. And it dramatically limits it. My best example of that, sorry for what it's worth, but it comes from, as you can imagine, given my gender, given the, you know, as a registered nurse earlier in my career, you know, maternal health was really not my area of expertise. It was a pretty awkward space to be honest with you. I mean, teaching breastfeeding to someone is by definition very theoretical for me. Okay? Labor and delivery, on the other hand, was a pretty cool place to be if you knew anything about behavioral sciences and about anxiety. Because at that point, when all of a sudden, and it occasionally would happen, panic would start to set in at certain points, okay? The ability to be able to literally get in mom's face and get the focus down, recognizing the fact that attention is now pinpoint in light of physical discomfort, fear of a new experience, all the other things that are going on. We got to get out of anxiety and just focus. Look at my mouth and breathe like me. There was one chance in my life. One of my children came blessed by adoption, the other via obstetrician. I had to have one wonderful opportunity to practice those great skills, of course, with my now wife of 27 years. And we had all these hand signals. We were ready to go. You guys had me do this. We knew, we were well-practiced. I'll tell you. We knew exactly what we were doing. And she's in transition, and there's a lot going on here, and I'm right there in front of Siobhan's pretty face. Breathe, breathe. And she's giving me the signal I've never seen before. And she's waving, and she's waving, and she's waving. And she's trying to breathe, and she's trying to breathe, and she's waving and waving. And finally, it's, honey, honey, what does it mean? I don't know what. Your breath, it's rank, it's bad. Okay. Sorry, little quick diversion. We replace anxiety with information. We de-stress the decision-making process itself is the next step. We simplify the finances. Now, please understand, my industry thrives on the fact that finances aren't simplified. I mean, why else would you need us, okay? So we're going to do everything we possibly can to make everything sound as, that's a little bit overstated, but many of you have great advisors who bring this down into very practical ways for you, and God bless them for that. But yes, there is a part of the industry that justifies itself by making it as complicated as possible. Some of the stuff is complicated, but at this moment in your life, you got other things to be thinking about than necessarily how to manage your portfolio and what options and derivatives mechanisms you should be using to hedge against risk in your portfolio. Nah, this is a time to kind of focus on how we're going to take care of basic stuff. And then lastly, I want to make a couple of comments for those of you who are caregivers or might be caregivers at some point about putting your own house in order and how that might be best, okay? Let me cruise through this, starting with this issue of anxiety, just outside of my dumb maternity stories. God has something to say about this. Surprise, surprise. And Paul, in writing to a very, very stressed church at Philippi, at the time, politically stressed church, practically stressed church at that time, says the following. He says, don't be anxious. I'm paraphrasing, but hey, it was in Greek, so aren't we all paraphrasing? Don't be anxious for anything, but in everything, by prayer and petition, with thanksgiving, present your request to God. And the peace of God, which transcends all understanding, will guard your heart and your mind in Christ Jesus. Now, the fat words, in hip-hop land, that would be P-H-A-T, the fat words in that, the heavy words, would be with thanksgiving. So that old adage that our grandmas and great-grandmas used to tell us about, count your blessings, count your blessings. Count your blessings is a spiritual discipline and an extremely useful one, particularly when you're in the midst of it and you're dealing with anxiety. So then the peace of God, which goes beyond understanding. So what are we talking about? Well, what we're saying is, it says, I'm going to pray, I'm going to bring my petitions to God, who knows everything and controls everything. I'm going to do so with a heart of thanksgiving. I got to work on that one on my own. I'm going to bring this thing forward. Confess my bitternesses, confess my resentments, confess my regrets. I'm bringing this stuff forward in a true, honest prayer. And then the cool stuff starts to happen. Beyond psychology, beyond human nature, the supernatural stuff starts to happen. And for the life of me, I can't figure out, I should be just as upset as I was yesterday. I don't know why I have this sense that I'm going to make it, that we can keep going on, that we're going to have the strength. Many of you know exactly what I'm talking about. And when that happens, guess what? Positive feedback loop, more thanksgiving. Because the very fact that that happened in your life is one more reason to say, He is there. He's been there all along. He told me He'd never leave me or forsake me. And it was true. Till the next time comes up that I go back through again. Sometimes we can replace that anxiety. One of the things that we can practically do after setting our hearts in that way is to replace that anxiety with information. Okay. I talked to you before about function and epidemiology and the like, the importance actually of the clinical elements of this. I'm going to strongly encourage you to you. I'm not a commercial for the geriatric assessment units. Yeah, I used to work in one. I believe in the model. The concept is that throughout our community, at different, usually affiliated with hospitals, one time I was only teaching hospitals, now it's much more pervasive. You will find folks who are board-certified geriatricians or behavioral neurologists or geropsychiatrists, depending upon the discipline that is needed, but also on a team with geriatric nurses, with geriatric social workers, sometimes with occupational therapists or physical therapists, that work in a team concept. And much of what they do for many, many people is a second opinion. They give a comprehensive overview second opinion. There's a place for it. It is not a substitute for the relationship of a primary care physician. But I got to be honest with you, occasionally accessing one of those units appears to the primary care physician like a threat. And it's important that we as a community say, you know what, we'll have to manage that relationship. As we manage it, we'll show appropriate deference to the primary physician. Relationships, and this is true in business as well as it's true in our medical care, relationships trump transactions all the time. Sweet old businessman once gave me some advice when I was an MBA student, said, Richard, never let your lawyer do your deals. Now, you have to understand this. I have great respect for my legal colleagues. Both of my brothers are attorneys, so great disciplines, love what they learn. I've learned a lot from them, but he said, never let your attorney do your deal. And I said, well, why? And he said, because attorneys are trained to make sure that you maximize the transaction. I said, yeah. He said, oh, business is not about transactions. Business is about relationships. He was a quite successful man. He said, I give up transactions all the time in exchange for a good relationship. So likewise, I'm not saying that somebody popping in once, reviewing all the records, looking at all of the medicines, looking for any opportunities for polypharmacy, making sure that we're not missing anything in terms of diagnostic tests, to do that at least once in the midst of this person's life is a substitute then for an ongoing, continued relationship, regular relationship with a primary physician who has all the records, all the history, all there. No, not at all. The two work in consort. But whether it's done by the primary physician in the community or whether it's done at one of these assessment units, somebody actually has to go through that process of looking at all the medications. We'll talk for a second about the Medicare system, the health insurance system for most folks who are 65 and older or disabled or blind. Medicare, the largest public health insurance that we have, medical insurance that we have here in our country. Well, for many people, the way in which they receive their Medicare is wonderfully flexible compared to those of you who are on, say, employer-sponsored plans, where you have a cadre of doctors that you must see those folks, certain institutions that you must use for your services, and so on and so forth. A formulary of products that you can receive. In the Medicare world, many people in traditional Medicare can go see any doc they want to. Probably can see many docs about the same thing anytime that they want to, as often as they want to. In most cases, that doc will still get paid. And so they can kind of bounce around. So you could have physicians that have prescriptions that have six or eight different physicians' names down on the... And increasingly, we're almost, to some degree, given up in health administration of trying to control it at that level. We're now controlling it at the pharmacy. That at least if they all keep going to the same pharmacy or the same pharmacy company, at least it'll be up on that computer screen. And if there's drug interactions between those things, something will beep off. So all of a sudden, one of the emerging areas is the software to be able to catch that at that level. Because the health finance system says it's perfectly acceptable for you. If you didn't like what that doc said, go find another one and see what they think. And if they think maybe a little bit more of this might work, they may not necessarily be very clear with you. You're supposed to dump the other stuff first. And so occasionally, whether it's with one physician, and that would be the best way in terms of longstanding relationship, or at least at some point during, think of how morally unconscionable it would be to move forward in planning this person's legal and financial affairs. And there was something that if not take away the problem, it could have at least ameliorated a portion of it. And so clinical we start with at that level. Get some information about what's actually going on and what it might be excess disability for this person. Second piece would be to know what the available community services are. We happen to live in Northeast Ohio. We're rich in medical and social services available for folks that are dealing with caregivers. Now, getting information about those services is not always necessarily the easiest thing to do. There are, the best example I can think of for it is we have, to my mind, across the nation, when I look across the nation, here in Northeast Ohio, these five counties, we have, across the state of Ohio, we have an exemplary system of information about long-term care facilities, nursing homes, assisted living facilities, down to the level that I can go on to, get ready, scribble this one down if you want to, litcohio.org. Or I can just go to the website of the Ohio Department of Aging, and it'll say a thing right on there that says the Long-Term Care Consumer Guide. And I can click on that. What happens then? Well, I get this really cool website. They can give me information about all the licensed facilities. I can narrow it down by the number of miles I'm willing to be from a particular zip code. I can do this amazing searching. Hypertext can take me in not just to tell me what the residents or the families thought of this, but literally what the inspectors that came out from the Department of Health thought about this particular place. And if I hypertext in even deeper on the next one and the next one, I can literally get down to the point of reading the note of what that nurse assessor said about what she saw that she or he saw that created that violation. Does that necessarily mean I'll understand what I'm reading? No. So the data is there. Whether that data can be transformed into information depends upon who's reading it. And so we haven't quite gotten to that point yet where we have a clear system in place, and hence we still need phone lines, things like that. Yeah, a great question, because if you go, for instance, to the Medicare.gov site, Nursing Home Compare, first off, it's a different set of data that you get. You're getting it heavily from the folks that provide skilled nursing services, which is what Medicare pays for. We'll talk about that in a second. Not necessarily the broader services that you would get that you might be most concerned about in terms of custodial kinds of care. But more importantly, quantitative is helpful. But there's an old Mark Twain quote about statistics that I won't share with you right now. You can do some Google searching on your own about the value of statistics. But in any case, there are... let me give a best example I can think of, okay? If you go to that site, LTCOhio.org, you'll see a ranking. Say, I want to go 10 miles radius from my home or my zip code. I put that on in, all right? So I'm going to put in 44139, and I'm going to hit this button, and I'm going to see Solon and Twinsburg and Aurora and the surrounding area there. I'm going to see a bunch of different facilities. And I may even be able to nail that down and tighten that up, saying, I only want to see the ones that have dementia care, or I only want to see the ones that have PT available for rehab or something like that. Okay? So I search this thing down. And I'm going to see a list of all these facilities. I'm going to click onto the tab that says, hey, show me what the Department of Health thinks of these people. And I see that one of them had 7 violations on their last inspection, and another one had 4. And I look and I see the statewide average is 5.2. And I think, oh, 7? Forget that 7. I'll go with the 4 guy, right? Of course, then if I click down a little tighter, I discover that the 4 were fall down, go boom, resident neglect, and possible financial exploitation. Okay? I go over to the 7, and I see that somebody didn't get Mantu tests for TB for all their members of their staff, their paperwork wasn't in place, and there's questions about billing. The quantitative measure doesn't necessarily guide me. When I go to one of the sites, including Nursing Home Compare, my concern is, fine, they'll give me an A, B, C. But you know what? I was a professor. A, B, and C means very different things at very different universities with very different students in very different classes. And so I'm not sure I want that. I actually want the data so that I can create information. The challenge is, can we learn and can we develop that function within our society to help people take all that information, or that data, and turn it into information? And that's kind of where we're going with it. Take a look at the site, if you would, and if we ever get a chance to talk on the phone or something, I always appreciate it if you're in that process or looking at that process, or frankly, you have a loved one who's living in one of those facilities, yes, absolutely, let's go look at that facility. It needs, yes, please.
Is there a site available like that for other states?
Great question. Some, not all.
How would you go about finding
them? Yeah, it's how do I go about? No. It's because that's not an uncommon consultation that I end up being asked to do. Is that I have family in multiple states and we're looking at multiple states and trying to make a decision. And some of that is policy considerations about Medicaid and things like that and how they're managing it in their state and what their resources they're doing. In any particular few county area, the country is broken down into what are called planning and service areas, PSAs. In every PSA, ours happens to be a 5-county area, Cuyahoga, Lake, Lorain, Geauga, and Medina counties. Okay? So those of you from Summit, sorry. That's a different one. So planning PSA 10A is the one I just described for you. 10B, incidentally, is the Summit, Stark, maybe Tuscarora. I'm not sure exactly where that fits out. In any case... So they have these areas that are federally set. Every one of those areas has what's referred to as an Area Agency on Aging. For the 5 counties I described to you, they're called the Western Reserve Area Agency on Aging. So there is, in any community, a first place that you can go to start to get information. In fact, I would commend to you all, the Western Reserve Area Agency on Aging has an excellent little guidebook that they'll send to you for free. Now, yeah, is it a repository for all the advertisements from the home care companies? Sure, but you know what? There's some really good stuff in there. And it'll give you sort of a broad idea of what's out there in the community when you start to think about resources. And it'll open up your mind to some resources you never even thought existed that might be the right fit for right now where you are in this continuum of care. So the area agencies on aging across the country are always the first place I would go. Likewise, every PSA has an ombudsman program. Some that might be one volunteer. I had to do some work in Kentucky for a while. It was an interesting experience because there just happened to be few people living in that particular area. It was one volunteer person on the phone. And conversely, our Cleveland office, I think I had 23 people that reported to me that were all either licensed social workers, licensed independent social workers, or attorneys. So, you know, depending upon where you are, there's different resources and allocation of those resources involved in providing those services. But that's the basic structure across the country. Start with the area's agency on aging, and there is a long-term care ombudsman function in each of those areas.
Yeah. Richard, I have a senior that I'm responsible for in Colorado. And
yeah.
From my experience, the facility that she's in had an ombudsman. So I took that and went to the PDSA and went to the state the other way around.
Good. That'll work. And that's always a blessing, depending upon where it is. You know, the idea behind the ombudsman program, the quintessential idea is that there would actually be a trained, if not professional, lay person assigned to each facility that knows those residents and is regularly in contact with them. That's overwhelmingly the best. Okay, so available community services, but think broadly in terms of services. Respite services, in-home services, as well as facility-based kinds of things.